We're talking about a new book that traces the origins of the opioid crisis in Big Pharma through the family behind the drug OxyContin. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Opioid overdoses have surged in the pandemic. That's from new preliminary CDC data out this month. More than 87,000 people in our country have died of drug overdoses during the 12-month period ending in September. And Wisconsin's upward trajectory is following the nation. Have you or a loved one battled an opioid addiction? What do you want to know about the people and motives behind OxyContin? It's 800-642-1234. Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer at The New Yorker. His new book is called Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Patrick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you.
Well, let's start with OxyContin itself, the brand name for the strong prescription pain med that contains an opioid. What was so revolutionary about this drug from Purdue Pharma when it was introduced in the 90s?
So you have to go back, yeah, to the 1990s, which was a time when a lot of American doctors were quite reluctant to prescribe strong opioids like this to patients. They would reserve them for, you know, severe cancer pain, for end-of-life care, but there was a reluctance to prescribe them for, say, moderate pain, you know, a back pain, an injury you might have gotten on the job, post-surgical pain, and the reason for that was there was a longstanding concern that these drugs could be quite addictive. And what was novel about OxyContin is that Purdue Pharma, this company, really set out to make an opioid that would be prescribed much more widely, that wouldn't just be for the cancer pain market, but would really be for everyone. They estimated that there might be 40 to 50 million Americans who suffered from undertreated chronic pain, and that was the market they wanted to go after. But they realized to do that, they needed to persuade American doctors that these drugs weren't actually as addictive as they had long believed them to be. And so that was what Purdue did. It went out with a kind of a marketing plan claiming, we now know this was not true, but claiming that OxyContin would be addictive. If it was prescribed by a doctor, it was addictive less than 1% of the time.
Wow. The mantra from the pharma reps was to start with and to stay with. And so really, this was a drug that they were trying to push for using for months, for years, a lifetime.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, their idea there was, look, this isn't some heavy duty nuclear solution that you graduate to only after other courses of therapy don't work. This should really be the first line of defense against pain. Again, you know, if you're a big pharma company and you're trying to sell a lot of pills, you can see how that would make sense. But as a consequence, what it meant is that the drug became very, very successful, and more doctors started prescribing these types of strong opioids.
So as more and more doctors are prescribing these opioids, the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma are making more and more money. And now you're talking about this storm of lawsuits you see going on and government investigations. Can you take us to the present and what you see there as states go after Purdue Pharma?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we now know that almost immediately after the drug was introduced in 1996, there were signs of problems in some parts of the country with people abusing OxyContin and becoming addicted and overdosing and dying. And those problems have only intensified over the decades. It took some time, I think, for the relevant authorities and the public at large to wake up to the fact that this was happening and that there might actually be some culprits. And so what happened in the case of Purdue Pharma, this is a company that has now pled guilty to federal crimes twice. They pled guilty in 2007. And back then they said, hey, you know, we won't do it again. We're going to clean up our act. And turns out they didn't. They pled guilty again to a new set of federal crimes just this past November. And then in the background, what we've seen is more and more states suing Purdue Pharma. And I should say, not just Purdue Pharma, other opioid makers as well, including and pharmacies and wholesalers. There are a lot of lawsuits associated with the opioid crisis, but there's about 2,500 lawsuits against Purdue Pharma. And now I think every state in the union, pretty much with the exception of maybe one, is suing the company. And half of the states are also now suing individual members of the Sackler family, this family of billionaires who own the company.
We're talking with Patrick Radden Keefe. He's author, investigative journalist. His new book is called Empire of Pain. You can join in. Are you following the ongoing legal disputes involving the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma? Are you a physician or healthcare provider? What do you see in these drugs? Do you work in the pharmaceutical industry? What is your take? 800-642-1234. Patrick, introduce us to the three Sackler brothers, Arthur, Mortimer, Raymond, all three physicians, and you found that they had been so close during this period when they built their empire. What was their business acumen like?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, this part of what I wanted to do in this book was write a book not just about the opioid crisis per se, but actually tell the whole history of this family, which is fascinating and really kind of informs the growth of Big Pharma as we know it today. So these were three brothers born to immigrant parents in Brooklyn in the early decades of the 20th century. They grew up during the Great Depression. They faced terrible anti-Semitism, and their parents wanted them to grow up to become doctors. That was their greatest hope. Arthur Sackler, the oldest brother, said that by the age of four, he knew he was going to be a doctor.
Wow.
And they all become psychiatrists. And they had a very idealistic view, I think, of medicine and what new kind of pharmaceutical innovations would be able to do in terms of bringing relief to people who were suffering from various types of ailments. But they also had a very strong entrepreneurial drive. And I think some of this came from having seen their family lose everything during the Depression. They wanted to go out and make money and find real financial comfort. And so Arthur started out not just working as a physician, but also in medical advertising. So there's this whole period in the 1950s when he's kind of a Don Draper figure. he comes in and he sets up his own. He sort of takes over a medical advertising firm and starts advertising drugs, including Valium, which makes him very, very rich. And he revolutionizes the whole field of how drugs are marketed to doctors. And he actually becomes so successful that he ends up buying a pharmaceutical company called Purdue Frederick and giving it to his little brothers, basically setting up his brothers in business, running this pharma company, Purdue.
And he thought of medicine as this fusion of technology and human experience. What did he see there? What does that mean?
So Arthur really thought of himself as kind of a Renaissance man. He was very interested in the sciences, but also in the arts and in culture. And he had a notion of doctors as almost more than human. You know, he talked about doctors as if they were priests, like a kind of a priesthood where they can't be corrupted. They're unimpeachable. They're just the most noble species walking the earth. And he had a lot of confidence in technology. So there's a chapter in the book about the early years when the brothers worked at this very barbaric insane asylum in Queens, New York. And their job was to treat patients suffering from schizophrenia and other conditions. And they would use electroshock therapy. They had to perform this procedure thousands of times, and they hated it because they thought it was crude and cruel to the patient. And they sort of fantasized that one day there would be a pill that you could give people. And that, in fact, for any problem that humans suffer from, any health problem, maybe someday there would be a pill.
We are exploring the harm of the prescription painkiller OxyContin, how the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma have built an opioid empire. Patrick Radden Keefe's new book is called Empire of Pain. Are you a physician? How do you decide what pain medicine to prescribe and at what dosage? Are you a pharmaceutical rep? How do you get physicians to prescribe your product? How do you feel about the way pharmaceutical firms advertise and market? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Patrick Radden Keefe here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show as we learn about the family behind the prescription painkiller OxyContin. I'm Kate Archer, Ken. Thanks for being here. A growing number of lawsuits allege Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, deliberately downplayed the risks of its addictive pain medicine as it marketed to physicians and patients over the decades. And since then, according to federal data, nearly 247,000 Americans have died due to overdoses involving prescription opioids over a 20-year period. Did you get prescribed OxyContin after a surgery or for chronic pain? What happened? How are you now? What questions do you have about pharma tactics? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Patrick Radden Keefe of The New Yorker, who's been stitching together the Sackler family story for years, and he's with us for the hour. Dan is joining us in Madison. Hi, Dan. What is your story with OxyContin?
Hi. I was injured in about 1998. Tried just about everything to quell my pain. I had both my legs, my femoral arteries were occluded and had no blood flow. The pain was enormous. Tried other medicines, made me sick. Finally, you know, I pushed back on taking that kind of medicine. And finally, I tried it, and it's the only thing that allows me to be functional and to contribute to society. And I'm tired of getting lumped into this group of people who are using this stuff irresponsibly, you know. And what about all the counterfeit stuff out there that comes from Mexico that's laced with fentanyl that they sell on the street for $100 a pill? You know, I would not be able to function without this kind of medicine, and I take it responsibly. And I would bet that 99% of the people that are prescribed this kind of medicine do take it responsibly. And what about us? I don't hear anything on the radio about people that take it responsibly, you know, who I see my doctor, I have a contract. Every 3 months I see him, he counts. And without it, I'd be an invalid. I'd be costing the government, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Dan, thank you for sharing your story. Dan needing to take this in order to live and survive, Patrick.
Yeah, it's a great point. Thank you for calling, Dan. And I'm glad you told your story. I hear from pain patients like Dan all the time, many of whom are, you know, you can hear the concern there, right, that there's a fear that they're getting stigmatized because of the discussion about this drug. But also a lot of people are worried about access. They worry that, you know, if back in the 1990s, there was a kind of, you know, the pendulum swung very far in one direction with doctors prescribing these drugs left and right. There's a fear that the pendulum could swing too far in the other direction and make it difficult for pain patients to have access to the medications that they need. So let me say a couple of things. I mean, one, which is an important point to make clear, is I'm not arguing for the prohibition of these drugs at all. I don't, you know, as a general matter, that's not where I come down here. And I think it's certainly the case that OxyContin and other strong opioids have made a huge difference in the lives of many. You know, these are miraculous products. I certainly wouldn't dispute that. Having said that, you know, what I'm concerned with is the fraudulent marketing of these drugs as having, you know, very few side effects and no real risk of addiction. Where I would take issue with Dan is when he talked about how he uses them, these drugs appropriately, unlike these other people. And this is something that the company has said since the very beginning. When there were first indications that that some people were abusing OxyContin and becoming addicted to it, members of the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma argued that there's basically two kinds of people. There's legitimate pain patients, like Dan, who have a serious condition. They see a doctor, the doctor prescribes them OxyContin, they take it exactly as directed, and that they should have access to these drugs, and those people never have problems, and that the drug is not addictive for those people. And then on the other hand, there are drug abusers, people who are basically criminals. They're people who would be abusing any kind of drug. And they, you know, they choose to get OxyContin, you know, on the black market or through a, you know, a phony prescription of some sort. And, you know, through a pill mill. And they abuse the drug. And if it wasn't OxyContin, they'd be abusing something else. And this is really a story not about the possibility that OxyContin could be addictive, potentially for some people, but a story about how those people are irresponsible and they're drug abusers. And I tend to resist that idea. I don't believe that people break down neatly into those two categories.
It's not that clear cut.
It's not that clear cut. And I, which is not to say that Dan isn't 100% right, that he takes the drug responsibly. He relies on it to live his life. And that he should be entitled to continue doing so. I think the problem is you have a third category of people, and it's a pretty big one, who are people who are prescribed the drug by a doctor, and they find that they become addicted in a doctor's care. To this day, the Sacklers insist that doesn't happen, but I'll give you just one statistic. United Health, which is one of the big health insurance providers, did a study recently, which I cite in the book, where they looked at all of the people who have United Health for insurance, who were prescribed OxyContin by a doctor and subsequently diagnosed with an opioid use disorder. So it's not just that they're addicted, but actually they have an official diagnosis of an opioid use disorder. And according to United Health, this one insurance provider, the number of hits that they got who satisfied both of those conditions were in the hundreds of thousands. There were hundreds of thousands of people just with this one insurer who, you know, like Dan, were prescribed the drug by a doctor. This is not a drug they're buying off the street. This is a Purdue opioid and subsequently were diagnosed with an opioid use disorder. So I think I'm not suggesting this is an easy issue at all. I think it's an extremely hard issue. But I would just remind Dan and other listeners that this is a company that has pled guilty to federal charges twice. This is a family that has taken $10 billion out of the company. I think in some ways it is because Purdue overplayed its hand and tried to make this a drug for everyone that you're now seeing a situation in which some pain patients are worried about having access to a drug that they need. They were not the ones who the company was really marketing hard to begin with. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the company got greedy and wanted to market it to a much broader range of people. And that, I think, is part of the reason we find ourselves where we are today.
We're talking with Patrick Radden-Keefe, who is the author of Empire of Pain, as we explore the rise of the strong pain med OxyContin and the family behind it. John is joining us from Green Bay with a story about this drug. John, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to comment. It's real. My mother, when I was 18, I went off to college. She fell into a coma, had necrotizing fasciitis. 99% of people die from that. She somehow made it. But while she was in the hospital, she was in there for 2 months. They'd given her fentanyl and Demerol and OxyContin and the strongest drugs possible. She didn't even know who I was. And then after she got out of the hospital, they don't give her any treatment plan or anything like this. So she's just been addicted to it for like 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it's sad to see. And that's why I'm a strong proponent for some type of alternative medicine or something, because these pills kill. I won't even take a Tylenol today.
Oh, John, thank you. Yeah, thank you for sharing your story. And, you know, John saying that his mother, when released from the hospital, had no treatment plan and had been on a cocktail of these drugs.
So this is, yeah, I mean, this is, it's, I'm really glad that John brought that up because he gets at a big part of the problem here. You quoted earlier the tag phrase that Purdue came up with for OxyContin. They said it's the one to start with and the one to stay with. And they had this army of sales reps who fanned out across the country, and they met with thousands of doctors across the country. And they would tell the doctors, you know, this is a wonder drug. It's amazing. It has virtually no side effects. It's addictive less than 1% of the time. And they really were very successful at persuading doctors to start writing more and more prescriptions for OxyContin. But what John is getting at is the fact that there was this big plan to get people on these drugs, but not a lot of discussion about how to get them off. And a lot of those doctors who ended up writing a lot of these prescriptions were not necessarily trained in how to slowly taper somebody off of opioids. And I've talked to many people who have been in this situation in which they are given a prescription for OxyContin or another strong opioid. They're powerful drugs that bring relief in the short term, but then they find that their body is kind of physically dependent on them, and their doctors don't really know exactly how to, you know, what's the off ramp here? Yeah. How do we help you get off of them?
Investigative journalist Patrick Radden Keefe is our guide to Big Pharma, marketing tactics of OxyContin over the decades. What have you heard about the Sackler family that you want to know about? Are you on pain meds now? What are the side effects? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Sackler family pharmaceutical empire and the rise and fall of the painkiller OxyContin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is called Empire of Pain. Patrick Radden Keefe writes about the pharma rep mantra that OxyContin was the painkiller to start with and to stay with, the rep said, and that this was a drug you could use for months, for years, a lifetime, a drug to stay with. Have you battled chronic pain or been on prescription meds for years? What is that like? Do you have an off-ramp type plan? 800-642-1234. Investigative journalist Patrick Radden Keefe is with us for the hour. Patrick, you found, and you said, a fog of collective denial about OxyContin among the dozens of people you interviewed, from the company, from sales reps to scientists, executives. And you also noted that there was an absence of internal whistleblowers on the OxyContin story. What struck you about these interviews?
Well, you know, I think that this story is a complicated one. And I think that from the outside, you look at it and there's a tendency to say, this is just a story of greed. Right. This is a company that generated $35 billion from this drug, and people start dying, and the company really chooses to ignore that. And in fact, to hit back hard at anybody who starts asking tough questions about their marketing. And you know, maybe you look at that and you think, oh, it's purely greed. I came to believe that it was a little more complex than that, that greed was definitely an important ingredient, but that also there was a kind of idealism at the beginning. You know, I think they really thought, we want to bring relief to millions of people who are suffering from terrible pain and make billions of dollars at the same time. And we have this wonder drug and we should be able to do it. And the real challenge was what happened when they started seeing evidence that this, you know, that it wasn't working out as perfectly as they thought that it would. And that, in fact, there was a, you know, a big black market in the drug, that all kinds of people were abusing the drug, getting addicted to the drug, that kids were dying from the drug. I mean, they started knowing that fairly early on. And rather than say, hey, let's take a hard look at our marketing, you know, again, I'm not saying they should have pulled the drug from the shelves. I'm just saying maybe they could have taken a pause and said, should we really be going out there and telling doctors and pharmacists and nurses that it can't be abused, when we have all this indication that it can be, or that it's not addictive, when we have all this indication that it is? Mm. And they didn't. And I think that that was a kind of denial. I think it was a, you know, and this is true for the Sackler family, but also many people who worked at the company. I think they kind of couldn't bring themselves to believe that, you know, what they had thought was this amazing experience they were having of doing right and doing well at the same time was actually much more complicated, and that they might have some share of the blame in having unleashed a real national crisis.
I found it interesting that you wrote the Sackler brothers despised generic drugs. Can you explain how their attitude toward generics, how this connects with the life of a patent and the patent cliff and kind of that business side?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, if you have a drug, if you develop a drug at a pharmaceutical company, you get a patent, which basically says that it's kind of a bargain that you make, where it gives you the exclusive right to sell the drug. Nobody else can make this thing that you've made and sell it in competition with you for a limited time. But in exchange for that, you need to publish your formula. You know, you can't have a secret formula where nobody else knows how you make it. Basically, in order to get that patent, you need to publish on the website of the Patent and Trademark Office the ingredients, how you put this drug together. And what that means is that when your patent expires, and the time varies, but you know, you've got say a decade or so when you'll have FDA approval and also an exclusive patent, you're the only one who can sell it, and you can charge whatever you want for that drug. Mm. And that's when pharma companies make the really big money, is when they're the only ones with this product and they can basically name their price. Eventually they lose the patent, and then any generic company can make the exact same drug, can just copy their drug and sell it for much cheaper and undercut them. And it's easy for them to do that because you've published the recipe for the drug with the patent. And that
I think we've just lost Patrick Radden Keefe. He's the author, investigative journalist. The book is called Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. As we look at the impact of opioids in America, you can join in at 800-642-1234 as we work to get Patrick back on the line. What has your experience been like? How much trust do you have in companies like Purdue Pharma, like Pfizer, Gilead? Do these names mean anything when you hear them? Tell us about your thoughts, your stories, 800-642-1234. Jim is joining us in Madison. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm just wanted to comment. Recently found myself in a rehab facility down in Florida, for some drinking issues. And I got to meet a lot of people that were addicted to opioids. And my perception of who they were was completely different than what I found out. They were normal people. And a lot of what I heard was the same message. When they were young, they were prescribed opioids, Oxycontin, and they became addicted. And throughout the years, they became more and more addicted to it. They started using different drugs and found themselves in a rehab facility. It's unfortunate that the doctors, the researchers, everybody, across the board, plays a role. You know, and I would say that, the consumer also plays a role. However, there still is an epidemic, and as far as what the answer is, not sure, but it's nice to see that some of the people that are responsible are starting to fess up. So,
Jim, what was it like after rehab for you, if I could ask?
Well, it was actually, once I became aware where I was, it became a realization that things weren't normal. It became very difficult. So I spent a good 4 months relapsing, had three relapses. And after that, I think I had some really good people around me. But I still keep in contact with my friends from Florida. I just had a conversation with a friend from Texas last night. And he told me a story that, somebody he had befriended, an opioid user, she overdosed, a couple weeks ago. You know, so it's a struggle. And if you're not in it day in and day out, you don't realize. But I guess the what I really want everybody to know is that opioid user, the one that you think about, the one that hides in corners, dresses dirty and is smelly, that's not the average opioid user. It's the professional. It's the, it's the common person. You couldn't tell one, by just looking at them.
Jim, so. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Patrick, do we have you back?
You do. I'm so sorry. I dropped off there.
That's okay. I mean, Jim, sharing just, going through the relapses, going through the rehab and just that long, long journey. I'm sure you have heard stories like that.
I've heard many stories like that. Yeah. And look, this was part of what I was trying to do in the book, is explain that to Jim's last point about how the opioid user is not the person that people have in their minds. when it first became clear that there was a problem with OxyContin, the Sackler family, it was really Richard Sackler, who was a second generation member of the family, a big figure in the company at the time. He said, you know, we need to hammer the abusers. They're the problem. He said, you know, these people are the scum of the earth, was the quote that he used. And I think there's been a really long campaign to stigmatize people who struggle with these drugs and suggest exactly that they're just kind of reckless criminals, was another word that Richard used to describe people. And the truth is, part of what I was trying to capture is these are very powerful drugs. They're very powerful drugs. And that means that, you know, in some instances, they can bring tremendous relief to people who need it. But it also means that they should just be taken very seriously, and doctors should take them seriously. Patients should take them seriously, because I've talked to many, many people like Jim who find that once they get their grip on you, it can be really hard to kind of break that spell. And lots of people relapse and lots of people die. And it's happened a great deal, even during the pandemic. You know, there's a pattern that many people who are listening may be familiar with that I certainly encountered in my reporting, which is that, you know, it's often said that these days the opioid crisis is no longer a prescription pill crisis. It's really a heroin and fentanyl crisis. And that's true. But it's also true that a lot of people who started using heroin and fentanyl were people who, if you'd asked them 10 or 15 years ago, they never would have thought of themselves as the kinds of people who use heroin and fentanyl. Mm. What happened was the on-ramp for them was pills, that they developed an opioid use disorder through pills. And then eventually they move over to these other chemically related opioids that are black market drugs, which in some cases are more readily available or cheaper, but are also extremely dangerous and lethal, like heroin and fentanyl.
Back to the business side for a moment here, as we had been talking about generics. And I'm just wondering about the FDA as well. How did the Sacklers view navigating the lengthy regulatory process for drugs like OxyContin?
Yeah. So one of the things that the Sacklers say even today is, listen, we didn't do anything wrong here. All we ever did was sell a drug that the FDA approved, and they approved our marketing. The FDA signed off on everything we did. And how you feel about that as a defense depends a little bit on how much confidence you have in the FDA to do its job. But I'll tell you one story. The guy at the FDA who was the chief kind of bureaucrat in charge of approving OxyContin back in, it was 1995, approving it for sale to U.S. consumers, but also signing off on the marketing language, mm-hmm. was a guy named Curtis Wright. And Curtis Wright turned out to be a pretty soft touch for Purdue. You know, there were other people at the agency who were asking tougher questions, but he really liked OxyContin. He liked Purdue. The drug passed in record time. It got a bunch of language approved, kind of marketing language, which raised some eyebrows at the time. There was a line in the original package insert that said that the particular kind of formulation of the capsule on the drug is believed to reduce abuse liability. And that's kind of a weird thing when you think about it. It's like, is believed by who? Like who thought this? And it was very hypothetical. They ended up having to take this line out. And to this day, nobody will say who wrote that line, whether it was the company or the FDA. But this guy, Curtis Wright, approves the drug. And then OxyContin comes out, becomes a blockbuster. And Curtis Wright thinks, you know, I think I'm going to leave the government. Hmm. And within a year, he goes to work at Purdue Pharma for a compensation package that was three times what he was making in government. It was about $400,000. So, you know, that's not somebody sliding a suitcase full of cash under a table, but it does feel like corruption to me that the main government official in charge of approving this drug subsequently leaves government and within a year goes and takes a big ticket job at Purdue.
We have Patrick Radden-Keefe, staff writer at The New Yorker. The book started as an article in The New Yorker years ago. Still time to talk about the Sackler Empire, the impact of opioids on your life and community. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to the conversation with investigative journalist Patrick Radden-Keefe. He interviewed more than 200 people, many of whom have worked for the Sackler family for his book Empire of Pain about Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin. The Sackler brothers, he writes, had always made a fetish of secrecy. The family did not cooperate with his research for the book, nor did the prominent family members grant interviews. Patrick Radden-Keefe is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's go to Jacqueline now in Lake Geneva. Hi, Jacqueline. You work in pharmacy?
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I did back in the day, but and in nursing. And now I'm a licensed social worker in Wisconsin. And I just wanted to shine the light on that no matter that the FDA and whoever approves of these dangerous drugs, the team and medical providers at the healthcare systems and agencies, they do not have to provide the drugs. They can have alternatives, much safer and much more economically better for everybody. So I'm a part of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in Washington, D.C., and now Vegan Primary Care. And I really think that the medical teams at the health systems and agencies need to explore safer options, that they also do not have to say, you know, yes to the sales reps who come and fancy them with food and all of these things to supply these dangerous drugs.
Jacqueline, thank you. Patrick.
Yeah, I'm so glad that Jacqueline raised that about the sales reps. This is one of the really fascinating aspects of this story, is that if you talk to doctors, as I have, many doctors will say, you know, yes, I know there's this big push by the pharma companies and these sales reps, but they couldn't influence me. I'm not influenced by that stuff. I mean, it's a little bit like people saying, you know, I see ads on TV, but they don't influence my buying habits. So this is a fascinating question, because the companies do invest in these sales forces, and they incentivize them to go out there and pressure doctors just to sell, as one of the Purdue executives in the book says, sell OxyContin. And they'll come by, you know, in the middle of the day with a meal and supply, you know, a takeout meal, anything to get just a few minutes of a doctor's time. And doctors will say, oh, this doesn't influence me. I wouldn't be influenced by a meal. But let me give you an anecdote. In the book, I talk about how Purdue Pharma some years would spend $9 million a year just on buying food for doctors. And you better believe they wouldn't do that if they didn't know exactly what the return on investment was. And they had run studies on this, and they saw, you know, if you do a junket and you invite doctors, those doctors will start prescribing more of your drug. There have been studies showing that even buying like a $10 or $15 lunch for a doctor is enough to change the way they prescribe. So I'm thankful to Jacqueline. I think that this is a really important issue, and you've seen a kind of revision recently. The CDC came out with some guidelines essentially saying, opioids should not be the ones to start with. These drugs are important, and they should absolutely be prescribed in some circumstances. But there may be other alternatives that you can turn to first in order to see if alternative courses of therapy that might have fewer potential downsides, you know, less danger of addiction and abuse, that those could work potentially as well.
I'm wondering how you feel about the Sackler family reaction to your reporting over the years, to your investigations, to your interviews, interviewing so many people, court records, tens of thousands you have read and incorporated. What did they tell you?
Well, this is a big book about a family that wouldn't talk to me, right? So what that means is I have to do my homework, enough homework that I can tell the story in a way that is compelling, where the reader will feel like, you know, I'm actually telling you something valuable and interesting about this family in light of the fact that they wouldn't talk to me. That's part of the reason I had to interview so many people. It's part of the reason that through a lot of court documents that have come out and through people leaking things to me, I actually really was able to tell the story in the words of the Sacklers, because I had access to, years and years of inside email, personal emails, different types of communications, so that you can hear the way the family talks behind closed doors. They've been trying to stop me from writing this book since before I started to write it. They hired a lawyer who has been sending me legal threats for 2 years now. There's a story I tell at the end of the book about a moment last summer when a neighbor of ours, I live in the suburbs outside New York City, and a neighbor of ours came up and said, "Hey, I don't want to freak you out, but there's a guy in an SUV who's been parked just up the street watching your house all day." I asked the family, the same guy subsequently came back and watched my house for another day. I asked the family if they knew anything about a private investigator watching my house, and they said no comment. Mm. I kind of took it for granted that when you write a critical book about a family of litigious billionaires, this is what they do. They try and shut you down. But I really stand by the book. I think the reporting speaks for itself, and I wouldn't change a word.
Well, you only have a few moments left, but I'm wondering, as you watch Purdue Pharma reorganize, bankruptcy, its opioid abatement, what's going on now with the company?
So you have this kind of crazy situation in which over the course of about 10 years, the Sacklers started taking a lot of money out of the company. They took more than $10 billion out of the company over the course of about a decade. And I think some people have argued that they did this knowing that eventually there would be a huge number of lawsuits against the company. Mm. So then what happened is when they'd taken about $10 billion out of the company and the company was down to almost nothing, they pushed the company into bankruptcy. And they said, "Oh, you know, too bad about all those lawsuits. The company's bankrupt now." But they managed to basically walk away with all this money. So this is all playing out in a bankruptcy court in New York now. The family is kind of on the sidelines. They haven't declared bankruptcy. And what they're saying is, we'll put up about $4 billion to help address the opioid crisis. We will admit no wrongdoing whatsoever. And we want to guarantee that no future lawsuits can come after us for any of this. So it's kind of an interesting question. You know, I mean, it's some states, I think, want to take that money because that's a lot of money. Other states feel like that's not nearly enough money and that the family would be walking away with much more. And this is, you know, they took all this money out of a company at a time when we now know the company was committing federal crimes because the company is, you know, just recently committed to a new set of federal crimes late last year. So that's where we find ourselves now. I think there's a lot of people wondering, are they going to get away with it?
Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Patrick Radden Keefe is author, investigative journalist. His new book is called Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. In Wisconsin, the Opioid Stimulants and Trauma Summit is underway with virtual events through June. It's focused on highlighting strategies to address the harmful use of opioids and stimulants in our state. Events are free, open to everyone. Find a link to the summit at wpr.org/mornings. And the Wisconsin Addiction Recovery Helpline is 211. It's sponsored by the Department of Health Services. The helpline is free, confidential, statewide. It operates 24/7. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.